Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. You know, before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the rise of outlaw country music and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision in her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to episode 353. This one's awesome. It's about famous failures. You know, so we've had a lot of major artists, a lot of massive songwriters come in and talk about, man, this is a time where some failure happened and they thought it sucked for their career, but actually it helped them in the long run, you know, from getting dropped from record labels and publishing deals to people that just told them, hey, as an artist, we don't think you have what it takes. Obviously, people are all massively successful now. So it's a reminder that you can win by losing. That's right. So, boom. Mike, what's your biggest musical failure? Your punk band?
Probably my punk band, yeah. I mean, we moved to Austin, Texas to try to make it. We toured Texas a bunch, but never quite got there.
And how did that make you better?
It taught me that even though you suck, if you find fun in it, it's still worth it.
Oh, I was going to say it taught you not to be in a punk band anymore.
That but, too. There's no money in punk rock.
Yeah, but that was tough, huh?
Yeah.
Nothing?
No, nothing. I don't think we made maybe more than like $200 the entire time as a band.
Oh, that's pretty good if you don't really have, if you can make $200 a night, and it's not good, but I'm saying that's pretty good if you can make a little money being a punk band back. That's just, yeah, nobody's going to pay for that, huh?
Yeah, it's tough.
And it's a tough little niche. Even if you are pretty big as a punk band, you're still...
Yeah, even the biggest punk bands don't make as much as you would think.
Once, I'll give you a musical failure. Once, was doing a show in Springfield, Missouri at a theater there. And I had been contacted by a family saying, hey, mom, she stage 4 cancer, but she wants to come to the show. And she'd love to meet you. And I was like, well, heck, can't believe she'd want to come to the show. I believe they said she was stage 4, and it was her bucket list item to meet me. And I was like, dang. Well, she had a cooler bucket, but you know what? I can actually make that happen. So she came, and I called her up on stage. I met her before the show, then I called her up on stage because she was just a big fan. And so I was like, hey, I want to in the crowds. Yeah, cheering for her. And I thought, well, let's just play a song up here, and I'll do a little dance with her. And I said, hey, just play the song that's next up, the next slow song on the list. And it was Ain't No Sunshine When She's Gone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was tough. We started, I was like, I think Eddie or Brandon or somebody was singing it. And it's like, Ain't No Sunshine When She's Gone. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Not this song.
Not this song. Anything for this song. And I'm like trying to, hey, go faster. It's not warm where she's away. I'm like, oh, God, this does not feel good with somebody who told me this. So that. And then I reached out after. I was like, I'm so sorry. They were like, no, it was awesome. And I guess they just didn't associate it with what I associated it with. They were just happy in the moment. And I was like, you know, sometimes she's gone.
Yeah, that's a rough one.
The whole time I'm like, oh, this is going viral for sure. So yeah, that's a pretty bad one there. All right, here we go. It's Bobby Cast with famous failures. We're going to kick it off with Shay Mooney from Dan and Shay on how getting out of his first deal led him to meeting Dan and forming Dan and Shay. Here you go. You go to college for a year.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you go, I need to go do music.
Yeah.
What was the point in going to school where it clicked? Where I was like, it's going to be tough, but I got to get out of school. And
it wasn't actually a school. It was actually a ministry school. So I went there. It was like a 9-month program. And I had a full ride to go to like a music school. And I decided right before, because my sister Gabby had decided she was going to go up to Pittsburgh to go to this like 9-month, you know, program. And I was just like, I kind of want to, I'm going to go with you. I'm going to do this. And it was kind of that I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do with my life. I was about to graduate and I didn't want to go to school for something that I already felt like I was, I didn't think I was going to like learn. And I, if I was going for like engineering or something like that, which is probably what I would have done, I didn't want to go to school for like a performance major, you know, and like learn how to sing. I just felt like that wasn't really the vibe. And so, yeah, I kind of took that 9 months and lived in Pittsburgh. And then right after that, I moved back home, which is when kind of the whole T-Pain thing happened.
Which is an interesting thing, too, because when you can really sing, you can also kind of pick where you sing.
Yeah.
And even I give Garth as an example. He was singing rock songs.
Yeah.
He was, he was kind of finding his place early. Yeah. So how do you get discovered by... Because what was it called? What was T-Pain? Was it called Nappy Boy?
Nappy Boy.
How do you get hooked up with them? How do they see you? What are the steps that led you to go there? Did you move to Atlanta for a while?
I did move to Atlanta. So I'd lived in Pittsburgh, and my sister was, she had this, she was super good. She a good dancer. Like she was a choreographer and did all this stuff. And she was, had met this guy named Mike, who was actually a backup dancer for T-Pain. And so we kind of all were hanging out there for a little while. And long story short, we get back to Arkansas after, you know, the school, after the 9 months. And we're there. And I just randomly get like a text, was like, hey, what are you doing? And I knew he had worked with T-Pain. And I guess he had sent some YouTube video of mine to T-Pain. And I was at Van Buren, actually. And I was in a movie. I'll never forget this. And I like, he was like, hey, like, he wants to like, you know, FaceTime you or whatever. And I was just like, I was in this movie. And I didn't have any service. And I was like, this is the craziest thing ever. So I go out of the movie, and my friend was like one of the managers there.
I was watching a movie. Mike, didn't you think he was like filming a movie?
Yeah.
I thought he was like doing Sling Blade in Arkansas.
You might have heard of this movie. It's called Hot Rod. It was like this little project I was working on.
So you leave the theater.
Yeah, so I leave the theater. So I walk outside, and I didn't have any Wi-Fi, and the service wasn't good enough. So I had to get on Wi-Fi. I think it was a FaceTime call. I can't remember if that was even a thing then, but either way, I didn't have any service. I had to like go get on the Wi-Fi. So my friend was the manager there and like gave me the Wi-Fi password. And I'm in like this back room at the movie theater, like FaceTiming or whatever, T-Pain. And he was like, hey, I want you to come to Memphis. Like we're playing a show there. It was him and Chris Brown. I want you to come, you know, play with us and do this whole deal. So I was just like, yeah, all right, let's
do
it.
What does do this whole deal mean?
I have no idea.
Oh, yeah.
To this day, I don't know what that meant. You know those moments like you get the call and you're just like, yeah, whatever it is, I'm down.
Yeah.
I'm in. That got me into a lot of trouble probably at some points in my life. Like, whatever that is, I'm doing it.
So do you go to Memphis?
I did. I went to Memphis.
Do you drive by yourself? Because you don't know what's happening. Yeah, so
I took an Uber there. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is crazy. Uber actually was not a thing then, I guess. But my sister, Gabby, she drove me up there. So I drove up there with her. We went to the show and met with him and basically go on the bus afterwards. And I think it was like T-Pain and his wife and Mike and all these people. And I'm just like singing. And just he was like, I want to sign you. You know, and I didn't know what that, I just heard, you know, I'm going to sign you. I didn't know what that entailed at the time or what that even, you know, looked like. But yeah, they ended up, you know, because I was writing, even when I was with him, when I ended up signing to him, I moved to Roswell, Georgia, which is out there, you know, just a suburb of Atlanta. And I started writing all kinds of stuff. I mean, I had been writing like country. And I'd been writing pop, I've been writing like R&B, like all this kind of stuff. But I knew that I wanted to do country. And that's kind of how the song that he had even heard me covering, I think was a country song. And so he was like, this is what I want you to do. This is blah, blah, blah. And basically what I did for that year and a half that I lived in Atlanta was just go into the studio every day till like 5 a.m. and just like write to beats and everything else. And it was just kind of it's kind of one of those just kind of honing my craft moments of like, I didn't really get anywhere. Like we didn't release any music or anything like that.
What was his goal with you?
I don't know. I'm not sure. The overall goal, you know, that was kind of like pitched to me was we want to sign you to a major, you know, we want to get you to Nashville at some point, but.
So they had country music in mind for you.
Yeah.
Even though it was T-Pain.
Yeah.
And we all go, oh, hip hop, R&B.
Yeah. And it was kind of one of those things that I didn't even have, like my sound, I didn't really know what I was doing either. I was just writing songs. And I had all these, you know, songs that I was writing that wasn't necessarily, I mean, they were like fine, but my identity was not found yet. You know, I just didn't really know what I was doing. So it's kind of somewhere in there. It's hard to put, unless I looked at a timeline, it's hard to put all this stuff into a timeline. But I remember there was a moment when I was there where I was just like, what? We haven't put out any music. We're not doing anything. I have no idea. There was not really, the contract I signed was a 360, and I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have a lawyer at the time, so I signed this ridiculous deal. And I think it was all good intentions on all parties, but I ended up at some point being like, I've got to go to Nashville. Like, I just have to get there. So I was getting, I mean, I had no money because I was getting paid, you know, whatever it was. I think I was getting paid maybe like, it was like $1,500 for $2,000 or $1,500 for like, you know, per month to like live on and stuff. But I was having to pay like $500 for my, you know, my rent in Atlanta. And then I had to pay $500 off the top to like my manager that was, you know, this guy that had you know, I had met in Pittsburgh. He was now my manager. And so yeah, it was a whole thing. So I had about, after I was moving to Nashville, I was left with about like $400 to like eat, and like pay all everything on after this and go out and expect to like, you know, try to meet people in Nashville, which $400 in a month is not a lot of spending cash.
How did you get out of the deal?
It ended up, you know, when I met Dan, it was a whole, I mean, there was a lot of people that kind of helped me get that out of the deal. And, you know, whenever we had met, it became kind of like a, oh man, what's going to happen? Because this is like a problem. I'm still in this deal.
Are you out of it now?
Yeah. Yeah. So, but it was, yeah, that was a pretty rough little time there for a little while, because it was a lot of feelings, you know, feelings hurt on, I think, on all sides. Cause it was just this, I don't know. I don't want to go like too into detail about it, but it was a rough time. I think in his life, he was going through a lot, and it was just kind of, I was just stuck. There was nobody to like talk to. He had gone away to kind of deal with some personal stuff. And yeah, it was just kind of, all right, well, I'm in this deal and we got to try to figure out. Whenever we were talking to these labels, it was like, it kind of became an issue because it rolled really fast. When Dan and I met, and we had kind of met with, you know, Jason Owen and Scooter, and things were kind of rolling. It was just like, well, this is a problem. And I was like, I was freaking out because I'm like, this is a huge opportunity and we're finally got something rolling.
Tethered to something.
Yeah.
That you can't get out of.
Yeah. And it was a full 360 deal. You know, it wasn't
like... Which means
like,
everything you're doing, everything. They have a piece of. Not just music, but if you put out a shirt.
Yeah.
Touring.
Yeah. Everything.
All of it.
And that was, yeah, it was a rough time. But we ended up, you know, really, you know, Scooter and Jason had a huge part of kind of getting me out of that deal. And but yeah, man, it was a tough, you know, start, you know, because it was just, even on that first record, like there was a lot being taken out, you know. And it was just kind of like, thankfully I didn't have... you know, a family at that time or no, you know, it's not like I wasn't completely broke whenever we had, you know, Dan and I had met and finally signed, you know, we had like a lot more money than I had, you know, to begin with. It was enough to live on, but they did a great job of kind of helping me get out of that. And, you know, Warner Brothers and Espo and all those guys, it was, yeah, everybody was really good. So,
the legend of the fort, which in different places we've talked about, but you guys met in a living room fort.
Yeah.
At a house, which you've been back by. I've even seen you guys post it before.
Yeah.
Dan was living in that house.
Yeah.
And you went over to the house?
I did. So I was living living with my buddy actually at the time. I think I was maybe, I don't even remember if I even was paying him, but I was basically sleeping on his couch for like a little while. His name was Brandon Metcalf, great guy. And he had a studio and I was like working a lot with him when I had moved to Nashville and kind of had my place. And there was a guy named Andrew that just one night, we had been writing a lot, and he told me, he was like, man, I'm going over to these guys' house. They had a band at the time. He's like, they're having a house party. You know, you want to come with me? And I was just like, yeah, sure, let's do it. And at that time, it was just kind of like, anytime you could go somewhere without spending any money, and you knew that there was like, we knew that there was a keg
free
there, and I was like,
free
this
entertainment
is,
and a little bit of
great.
Nourishment. That's
yes.
all you're chasing.
That's all I was chasing. I was like, do you think I got like pizza or something? Like, I haven't eaten in like a couple of days. But it was like, yeah, we showed up at this house, and little did I know that night was going to completely change my life.
You guys start talking that night. When was it that you said, okay, we're actually going to try something together, which means putting everything else aside? There's a difference in going, hey, we should do something together.
Yeah.
And going, we're doing something together.
I would even say it's comparable to in that part of a relationship where you're just dating and you go, we're only dating each other now.
Yeah.
So that means nothing else can exist except us. What was that point where you guys finally said we're just dating each other?
Well, it was not until just a couple weeks ago. It kind of happened. It happened really naturally where Dan and I started writing. Really, I think it was either that next day or like the day after that we had met. We were jamming till probably like 4 a.m. or something like that. And I think we had decided to write. So we get up the next day and we met at like a Starbucks or something. And then we ended up going to this guy that I was, Jesse Frazier. I'm sure that
he's been on the show. I know him and he's been here
love
before.
Love him. Yeah. One of the greatest guys. When I had quick side notes, this all makes sense. Jesse, when I had first moved to town, I had a friend and I asked him, I was like, who is doing like beats? Because I had been writing to a lot of beats. I'd been writing like country songs to beats, which is now like a common thing, but it was just kind of becoming a thing then. And I was like, who is a great track guy in Nashville? And the first name that my friend was Nash Overstreet, which is Paul Overstreet, songwriter. And he was like, Jesse Frazier. So I started writing with Jesse a lot. And then whenever Dan and I had met, I was like, let's go write with Jesse Frazier or at his place. So we ended up writing our first writing session. I think we wrote 2 songs that day. And one of them got put on hold that night for Rascal Flatts.
So what, you wrote a song that day.
Yeah.
They sent it out.
Yeah.
Maybe to Flatts because they thought it was sensible for them. That night it got put on hold?
I think it was that night. Yeah. Like when we got home, they were like, this is on hold for Flatts. And for us, we're like, things are heating up.
Wow.
Things are really, really good. Which if you know what a hold is, they never cut the song or anything like that. But for us, it was just like, it was legitimately like Rascal Flatts heard our song. That was a huge, and as small as that, you know, might seem now, you know, in our minds, it was such a big deal. Cause it was, you know, you have these big dreams when you're coming to town and it was kind of that first taste of like, whoa, this is like, somebody who has done it, who is a successful artist, they liked our song and put it on hold. So that was a huge deal for us. And that was kind of the fuel to be like, we should, let's you know, keep doing this because we liked, you know, what songs we were writing.
Would you compare that early part of you and Dan, and I don't mean this facetiously at all, but when you meet a girl, like when you and Hannah meet, and you're like, oh my God, this is it. Like it's similar to that feeling with him as it was, because if you're writing till 4 a.m, that's what you do when you talk to a girl till 4 a.m.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think for either of us, we just were kind of, it was different than when I met my wife, because when I met Hannah, I literally told my friend Benji Davis, who's a writer in town, I told him like right then, it was in Arkansas. It was like our first date. It was at George's Majestic Lounge. And I like walked her out to her car and I got back on the bus and I was like, I'm going to marry that girl. Literally said like that night. With Dan, it was like, we were having fun writing these songs. We didn't necessarily like, we thought they were good, but we didn't necessarily be like, we're going to make this
marry
is
each
it.
Other. Oh.
We're not going to, or marry each other. Neither one of those were on my mind. And I think it just kind of happened naturally to where like, we thought the songs were good, but as you do, you know, when it's your work, we thought it was good. And we knew, I think the most exciting thing for us was there was an aha moment, but it wasn't necessarily like, oh, we're going to be a duo. It was like, this is the kind of music that I've been trying to write. This is all, like everything has kind of led to this. You know, it was like the stuff that I had been wanting to write, but just hadn't quite found the sound yet.
So are you saying that when you two first started, it was like we found partners in creating more so than we're going to go be a duo?
It was exactly that. It was like, oh man, this is the kind of stuff. It was like better than any of the stuff that I had been writing in town. And I think for both of us, it was just kind of like, whoa, this is like, we got something special here.
So then how long until you decide you're going to actually pursue the artist thing together?
Yeah. So we started to, all these songs we've been writing, because we did start to write a lot together. And so the more that we wrote, we would just start doing like these writer's rounds and like playing these songs for our friends. And like our friends and everybody were getting hype on these songs. Like, this is the greatest song. Like we were in 507 Morton Avenue was the place. I can say it because we've said it a million times. I'm sure that the owner of that house hates us for probably talking about it all the time. But it was like, I think we went to the house one time I specifically remember. And I think it was P. Tracy, who now does all of our video stuff. It was his birthday. And I remember we shot like a fake music video for one of the songs because we thought it was so good. And it was just like, it was just ridiculousness. We were having so much fun. And it was just like, man, this stuff is really cool. So we started to play all the music out, like rounds and stuff. And then Dan and I, we had eventually like, there was actually an opportunity that we had to go down. And I had booked a show. It was just like Shea Mooney. and we were opening up. We did two shows together without actually being like a band at all. It was just like he was there with me and we were playing all the songs we had written. And one was at George's opening for Chris Allen. And I thought that I made it then. I was like, this is, you know, things are really starting to take off. And then another one we played was in Conway at UCA. There was this kid who booked me, and I thought it was going to be like the biggest show ever. And I think it was in their like little performing arts theater, which probably holds like, I don't know, maybe 1,500 people. And there was probably like 15 people in there. And right after that, we went down to Austin, Texas, because my lawyer had set up this like a showcase basically for us. And we went down, we put together a band, the whole deal. Dan and I drive down in my truck and we ended up playing the show. And it was, I'm not kidding, there was honestly probably like four people in the room. And one was my lawyer, one was like a bartender girl in the back, and then our friend Paul DiGiovanni, which ended up writing How Not To for us, used to be in the band Boys Like Girls. He was there, and then Dan's lawyer. And there was like no other people there. We rehearsed for like 4 days. And we thought it was going to be like our big break. And yeah, it wasn't our big break. But at that time, it was, I think on the way back from that trip, we kind of made the decision of like, we've been doing these shows together. Like we should do a duo. And I think it's hard to kind of put all this in my mind to like line it up. But kind of when we were writing all these songs, there was a guy who knew, he worked for Scooter Braun at the time. His name was Nano. And he knew Scooter, and he had kind of been talking to Scooter, I guess, about us. And yeah, during that time, Scooter ends up, we're at a writing session, and we had kind of decided like, all right, we're going to do this duo thing. And once we kind of decided that was when Scooter had heard about us, and we were in a writing session at a guy named Danny Orton's house. And he FaceTimes us and basically says like, I want to work with you. And Ed Sheeran was there, which is really funny because he was like, will you guys play that song that I like? It was a song called Stop, Drop, and Roll that was actually on our first record. We had like just written it. And he was like, play that song. So we played it. And at the end, he was like, my friend wants to hear the song because he really loves it. Because we had sent him maybe like a demo or something. And Ed Sheeran like pops in. He's like, hey guys, how are you? Which is like the worst Ed Sheeran impression. Hey guys, how are you? And we like sang Stop, Drop, and Roll acoustic like over FaceTime to him. And that was kind of the start of it.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink, shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events, there is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. TECOVAS.com.
TECOVAS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so here we go. Here's Luke Combs on the guy who told him he'd never be an artist after he performed for this guy. And pretty cool story, because obviously Luke Combs is the biggest thing in country music right now.
The tweet you posted where you said, I think the topic was, tell me something about yourself that no one will believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the gist of it was that you came to town and you had some songs and people were like, hey, they weren't good.
Mm-hmm.
And your whole thing was, don't let anyone let you stop chasing your dreams.
Yeah.
Those meetings where you were rejected, are they vivid to you, the early meetings?
Definitely. The meeting in particular was with somebody. It was, they have like the artist, like writer reps at like BMI. So I had a friend that had a rep there. And I went in and I was like very excited because I had just moved to Nashville at this time. And I didn't know anybody. You know, I knew a couple writing buddies and was going out and playing a few writers rounds and writing songs every day. And because by that time I was living off of those songs that I had put out the previous year. And I went in and it was kind of like this person was like, well, play me three songs. And I was like, oh, cool. Like this person's going to be like, I'm going to play these three songs and like they're going to walk me into the best publishing thing. And they're going to be like, this guy's great. Like, how could you not love this guy? Give him a publishing deal. So I played Hurricane, When It Rains, and One Number Away, which were my first three number ones. And they were like, okay, here's the deal. You got to get better at songwriting. You got to write better songs. And you're never going to be an artist. So that's it. And I was like, and I wasn't like mad.
Do you know who said it?
Yeah, but I'm not gonna say it.
I would never ask you to say it, but I'm just asking if you know who said it.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Have you seen them since?
I ran into them awkwardly at actually the BMI Awards.
Do you think they remember telling you that, or do you think you were just someone that was coming through, turning to the system?
I don't think so at all. Which is fine. You know, I have nothing against that person. You know what? Because I get it, man. I mean, it's like if you look at it, I would equate it to. At that level, you know, because you're not even screened at all at that level. Like any Tom, Dick, or Harry can walk in off the street pretty much to BMI and get one of those meetings. So I can't imagine the pressure of like, okay, well, I've got six kids that moved to town yesterday that want to come in and they all think they're awesome. And I've got to be able to figure out which ones I think are good enough to go on to the next thing. And so I wasn't mad about it at all. I'm actually very thankful for that meeting because I did go out and feel like I wrote some of the best songs that I had ever written because I was like, man, I gotta write more and do better. Like I'm not even close to as good as I need to be. And so I just kept my head down and I went and wrote a ton of songs. And then there were kind of the rest is just kind of fell into place. I mean, I know that's, you know, summarizing a big chain of events, but that's kind of how it felt.
I got a few minutes left here. I wanted to run a couple other things by you that I'd heard. First of all, a lot of folks come in, myself included, that worked retail because we kind of had to.
Yep.
You got to pay the bills somehow as you're mm-hmm. chasing your creative endeavor.
Yes.
And I worked at Hobby Lobby. Mike, who was in? Michael Hobby from 1,000 Horses worked at The Buckle.
Okay.
You worked at iZod?
I did.
How'd that go?
I was not a great fit at iZod, but I had, you know, I had as much fun with it as you could possibly have folding people's golf sweaters. You know, it was in an outlet mall, like one of those like Tanger outlets or whatever they call it. They had one in Blowing Rock, which is right down the road from Boone. So it was pretty miserable.
And how long did you do that?
I probably worked there for, I mean, close to a year, probably, I would think.
And whenever you are walking past a table of shirts that are messy, does it bother you, and will you refold a shirt?
No chance.
No,
no chance. But I'll tell you what, I do fold a mean shirt, you know, when I'm doing the laundry at home, which I'm sure people are surprised. Do laundry. My fiance does handle the brunt of the laundry, but I do chip in quite a bit, you know, help fold stuff, and you know, I'm not afraid to do laundry. I don't mind it at all. But
will you separate it, or do you just throw it all in?
I if I wasn't in a committed relationship, I would throw it all.
Because I throw it all in.
Yeah, but I do separate it now, just because that's what. But now it's like her stuff's in there, which is the thing. Like mine are just old, like gross T-shirts and jeans, really. So I'm not too worried about them like shrinking or like. But now there's this whole like, don't wash this thing with that thing, and don't dry this thing. But it's got to be tumble dried. But don't put it in with this thing that has to be high heat, and then some stuff is like cold water, and so it's, I mean, it gets pretty mathy to me, you know.
And we know you don't like
math. I don't like math.
You left Appalachian State because
I left school because
you didn't even take laundry. That was like year three.
That was year three, and I skipped laundry class. That's for sure.
The bank bag, I'm curious about. You used to save money in.
Yep.
So you went and bought one of those bank bags that zips, like it's kind of like your wallet
with the lock on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what was that about? And where was this money coming from you were sticking in the bag?
So I had started playing shows, and when Cappy moved to town after he started managing me, he had never managed anybody before. You know, he kind of blew through his life savings, like trying to build my career. And so he made a promise to me. He was like, hey, man, I'm not going to take a commission until you're actually making enough money to, like, live off of. And so at the time, you know, the gigs were, I mean, they could have been $250 a night. They could have been $1,000 a night. And those were, $1,000 was really good, you know. And so we would go and do those gigs. And, excuse me, I would take, you know, T-shirt money, whatever was left over. And Cappy was great because he would always go settle the show. You know, he would run me through the statement every night. Hey, here's what we got, and here's what we did, and here's the tickets, and this, and there would always we were selling out everything, you know, at that time, which is great on those club gigs because usually they'll kick you back a pretty like sweet bonus, and it's always cash, and so that's where the money was coming from, was that these sellout bonuses on these club shows, and so I was like I remember getting to thinking I had like $5,000 or $6,000 in my apartment, you know. And I was like, man, like somebody could just walk in here and like take this if they wanted to. So I had like a Folgers can, and instead of putting just the money in there, I put it in the bank bag and then rolled the bank bag up and put it in there. It was back like behind my microwave on my counter. My microwave kind of sat like in a corner, so it was kind of, there was that space behind it.
Yeah, because it was diagonal.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's where the money was coming from, and that's what I did with it at that time.
All right, here's one with Jason Aldean. And I was talking to Jason about this, and this is him now, because he didn't feel like this back in the day, but this is him now being glad his first record deal did not work out. You know, I mentioned all the number ones and all the success and awards, but I think, and if someone just was introduced to you, you are Jason Aldean, the country superstar, but, you know, I talk a lot and have written an entire book on failure and how important it is to learn. Like, if you look at your professional career, and you look back at a failure that actually made you a better entertainer, a better performer, any of that. Like, what was that thing that didn't work out? Or you're like, man, I'm kind of glad that didn't work out because I learned from it.
I would say when I got dropped from Capitol Records early on, I got signed to Capitol Records in about 2000, I think it was. And I was on the label for a year, never even recorded one song for them, and got dropped from the label. And so that was tough, man. It was like I'd spent, you know, that was the brass ring. That's what I was after. And to finally get that and to not even really get a chance to prove myself before I got dropped was just, I don't know, it did a lot. It was like, it was sad, but it also like kind of pissed me off a little bit. And to me, that was the thing that made me like really want to go out and kind of prove myself. And that's why when I got my next record deal offer, it was from Broken Bow Records, which was a little independent label Really didn't even have any superstars. I mean, Craig Morgan was over there and was having some just starting to have a couple hits. I think Sheree Austin was over there at the time and had a hit or two, but they really didn't have a whole lot going on. And so, you know, I signed over there with no clue how that was going to work out, but at least it was somebody willing to give me an opportunity. And I think for a long time, I sort of carried that chip on my shoulder to go out and really want to prove myself. So I would say that was the main thing.
Why would you be signed? And I understand why you would get dropped if you had put out a single that didn't do well, but why would they sign you and then drop you before giving you a legitimate chance?
Well, so I signed over there. The head of the label was a guy named Pat Quigley. And so when they signed me, and so literally before I could sign my deal, the new president came in, which is Mike Dungan, who is there now. And I've since talked to Mike, and we're great. Like, I love Mike. But he came in, and I just don't really think he got it. I don't think he was a believer in what I was doing at that time. And so I think he went ahead and signed the deal, but I don't think he was ever really a believer in it. And so ultimately it just kind of fizzled out and went away.
When you came to town, though, that was a bit of a jolt to the system. And, you know, on a much smaller level, like, I understand that, because when I came here, people were like, what is this? I don't understand it. It ain't going to. And I kind of had to beat it into submission. Mm-hmm. And here you were. You looked different. You sounded different. There was a little more of an edge. Did you get a lot of that? Like, I just don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, I go back and listen to some of the stuff we were doing early on, and as edgy as I thought it was at the time, I listened to it now, and I'm like, it really wasn't. But at the time, it was. And so, you know, I think there was a little bit of that. I mean, we were different than anything else that was out at the time. And so, but I think the best thing that could happen to me was, like, I didn't really know the rules. Like, you know, I didn't know there were rules. I didn't know you couldn't. I remember having earrings and that being a huge thing, earrings and a cowboy hat. And I'm like, really? I've had these since I was 17 years old. Like, it wasn't that big a deal for me. But
if you don't know the rules, you don't play by them.
Yeah. And so to me, it was just like, you know, you just kind of went along business as usual. And I don't think we really knew at the time that what we were doing was kind of, you know, changing the game a little bit.
With you having your own label now, Night Train Records, I would assume all of that you've learned along the way, both failures and successes, like, has made you a better head of a label?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think it's just experience, you know? I mean, it's guys, I mean, with other artists that we have, just having them be prepared for things, or if something pops up, it's like, you know, I'm sure that I've either gone through it or you know, have witnessed it. So, you know, it's... I can talk to those guys on a level of, like, okay, I've seen this before. I've been through this. This is what's going to happen. This is how you deal with it.
You're not just an executive. Like, you've actually – you are, but now you've done all of what they're doing. You've been through every single step of it, so you can empathize more than just sympathize.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, and you know, I try to be, you know, not only, like, kind of run the label, but also, you know, produce those guys. And, like, you know, a guy we're working with, John Morgan, he's on this new America's Songwriter Contest show that's out right now. You know, he's representing North Carolina. And so, you know, having a talk with him, he's like, you know, I don't know. This is an opportunity we have. You know, what do you think? And sitting down and talking to him about those kind of things. And, you know, it's just kind of been there, done that, and can at least give some insight into whatever it is they got going on.
That guy any good?
He's great. Great. Can't wait for you guys to hear him.
Have we not? Is nothing out?
He's got a song out. We released something last year just because we took him out on tour with us. It's called Coldest Beer in Town. And we just, you know, wanted to have something out on him while he was out on tour with us for people to go get. But his big launch is coming this year. So he was a writer on the Carrie duet, and he's also a writer on the new song we got, Trouble with a Heartbreak.
Here is Tim McGraw. And this is Tim McGraw's biggest failure. That happened when Bruce Springsteen asked him to perform at a tribute. Pretty funny story from Tim McGraw right here. Was there a moment in your career that you look back at that was a massive failure and you go, I'm really glad that happened because I learned a lot from it that allowed a lot of those successes?
Well, you know, you always learn more from your failures than you do your successes. And, you know, I certainly have had my moments where I wasn't the best person I could be or the best artist I could be. You know, I've had those moments for sure. But the biggest massive failure and embarrassment that I had was at the Grammy Cares one year. Bruce Springsteen, who's a friend of mine and one of my favorite people in the world, asked Faith and I to do Tougher Than the Rest together for the honor of honoring him at the thing. You know, all these huge artists were there. I mean, Neil Young, I mean, Sting, you name it, they were all there performing Springsteen songs. And anybody that knows Springsteen, you know, it's so hard to cover his songs because a lot of them are so left-footed and wordy and all that kind of stuff. So we're sitting at his table, and he goes, you know, at the end, I'm getting up and doing, what's that song? One of the songs. Anyway, we got up, and I said, sure, we'll get up and sing. So we're all on stage. All these artists are on stage, and it was one of those songs where everybody knows the first verse and knows the chorus, but nobody ever really knows the second verse. So we're standing there, and he turns around and says, hey, Black Hat, come sing the second verse. And I'm like, I can pull this off. And I go up, and I just a total fail. I couldn't find the phrasing. I didn't know the words. I mean, it was terrible, and I was so embarrassed. It was one of those nights I've just ruined my career. Luckily, because it aired, luckily I got to go back and fix it, and they were able to cut away, and so it didn't look like I forgot the words. But it was one of those things. I can't do it in front of everybody. But Faith was standing beside me, and I got up and tried to sing it. And when I stepped back, she did like a little bit of a sidestep away from it.
I don't know that guy.
That's funny. This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink, shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah, that's what the whole store basically is, fresh leather,
yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events, there is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com.
Tecovas.com.
Tecovas. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, here's Jimmy Westbrook from Little Big Town. This is him talking about how they got dropped from their first record deal just months after signing. At the time, kind of destroyed them. But now, very happy it happened, obviously. from that point where you meet Philip, when did you have to create the LLC, or that now it's an entity?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we aren't just friends that are singing, making $40 for mm-hmm. four of us to split. We're now going to pursue this, and if we're going to pursue it, it's got to exist. So when did that happen?
It was right around that same time. I mean, it all happened, like, from the time that I said I was going to do this to the time we, that was maybe at the end of 98 when we were having these conversations. I moved in February of 99. We were a four-person group, all the four existing members, and just a few months later had a record deal. So that was all super fast.
Getting the record deal.
I moved here in February, and we started. I remember I just opened up that branch of that company, and I was already going, "Hey, I'm not going to be able to come. We're going to go sing for some labels and that kind of thing." They were super. I was really upfront about all that when I moved. I'm like, "I have this intention, so you're probably going to run into this issue with me." And so when it happened, they were...
It's like Alabama football. I have an intention to watch the game. You're going to run into this issue. The bus isn't parked where I can get signal.
Thinking ahead.
Yes. That's pretty quick to get a record deal.
Yeah. I mean, we sang for six labels. We took one guitar. I didn't even really play guitar at that time. Took it in and sang live in front of all the record execs. And we got about five offers out of the six.
Jeez. So if I'm you, I'm going, well, we're one step away from fame and fortune.
Oh, it's on.
Yeah. When did you realize that that's not quite how it works?
Well, we got our record deal. The night we signed with Mercury Records, which lasted about 4 months maybe, we got a spot at the Opry to play. We only knew three songs. We played all of them. And then they immediately whisked us away in a limo to the airport to go sing at the De La Hoya fight for the national anthem. And when we were getting picked up in limos at the airport in Vegas, I was like, oh, this is on. And then we lost our we walked away from that. It was a handshake walk away not many months after that. So it was quickly a like, oh, This is not going how I thought it was going to go.
Well, I'm
going
to ask you, and I'll have you expand on both of these, but the harshest reality once you get a deal, and then, but then actually kind of the greatest fairy tale that, because you've been able to experience both. I'll say that you guys are, in my mind, if I'm just speaking of my thoughts and feelings here, which is often what I do, like you guys have really worked. Everybody works hard.
Mm-hmm.
You guys have worked hard. And you've had a boom, big song. I like what you guys do, though. You try to push in different directions.
Yeah.
And at all times, it's not always, people aren't always receptive of new things. Mm-hmm. And I always admired that you guys continued to try that regardless.
Yeah.
And so you say there's a gap, but in my mind, I'm like, yeah, probably a gap because people didn't understand what you guys were trying at the time, right?
Right.
Like, that's how I interpret. You're not saying it, that's how I'm interpreting mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
Because I've been able to experience a lot of it, not beside you, but running in a parallel path.
Yeah.
So when I say harshest reality, biggest fairy tale, you've got to have them both. Let's start with the harshest reality of what it is that you do and what you've had to experience.
Well, I mean, I think I immediately go to the time when I was just telling you that the Mercury deal started going awry.
How'd you know it was going awry? Did you feel it? Did something?
It was made... we were made aware that it was, without going into too much of the backside of all that, we basically signed at Mercury, cut a few sides, and when the powers that be at that time at Mercury heard the sides that we did, we cut about four songs, they basically said, hey, if any of this is who you are, we're not interested.
Oh, really? they were just were not interested.
Yeah. And so the harshest reality was, I think in that moment, I remember them saying all of that, and basically felt like we had an ultimatum. Like, I just remember going to the parking lot after that conversation, and all of the four of us sitting in a car, shell shocked. I mean, we just signed our deal. We had did, you know, the De La Hoya fight. This is, and then all of a sudden now that's about to be yanked out from under us. We're about to lose our record deal. But I tell you this, in that moment, and I think that was a pivotal moment for the band as far as what you're talking about of pushing and following our gut and our heart and where we musically want to go. We had that decision to make that day. And it was the hardest decision probably, oh, I know at that time that we've made. It was incredibly difficult because we were sitting there having to ask ourselves, is any part of what we just presented them us? And it was. You know, some of the production might not have been quite the right direction, but we're still experimenting, trying to figure out who we are. But the harmony structures and all of that of what we presented was us. So we made the decision ourselves that we were going to walk away from it, because if they're telling us that they don't want any of that, then we can't stay here. That's not going to be true to ourselves.
That's a tough decision.
And but it also set the ground work for who we became as a band, as far as living and dying by our own decisions.
Now, when I mentioned on the other side of that, like it's so great, it's weird. Like there, you're like, wow, this is going so wonderfully that it feels like it's the dream. Because I'm lucky enough to get those moments too. I mean, where you're just like, I can't believe it's happening.
I feel like I have so many of those moments, but it's always to me the unexpected, unbelievable moments, like collaborations that you do with people, or the being asked to be an Opry member. It's the things that you didn't even take the time to dream up because you're like, oh, I didn't know that was possible. It's kind of all of those moments of, you know, singing on a John Mellencamp record. Like, we ended up doing 9 songs on one of his records as the vocals for his thing. It's those kinds of moments that you get to share the stage with people that you're just like, I'm from Summerton. How am I standing up here on this stage with this person? And those are the moments that I'm so grateful for, and that you can't plan, that they just kind of work themselves out and happen. And it's, you just walk away going, man, what an incredible blessing this has all been.
Here's Russell Dickerson with his wife, Kaylee, on how he got dropped from his first publishing deal, getting paid to write songs, and how he sat on his first big hit, Yours, for 2 years before being able to record it.
That whole deal from back then, that pub deal, did it turn into all the things you thought it was going to, career-wise?
No.
You still with the same publishing company?
Mm-mm.
Oh, so you're out of all of that.
Yeah, that was that. The first, I signed in 2011. That was a 2-year deal, got dropped after 2 years. And then that was 2013. And I didn't even write Yours until 2014. And then I didn't sign a deal till 2016.
Well, so you had written that song and it sat for 2 years, huh?
Yeah.
Well, what's kind of the genesis of you writing that song, and it took a second for it to kind of happen?
Yeah.
So you write, like, just tell me about
the overall picture is January 20-something, 2014 is when we wrote it. And then January 20-something, literally almost to the day.
2017.
2018, 4 years later. 4 years is when it went number one. So 4 years in between that was I had one offer for a publishing deal. We took it. We had to.
Gotta pay the bills,
right? We just got married. Yeah. I got dropped the week we got back from our honeymoon. So that was a great.
Mm-hmm. We made $12,000 that year.
Yeah.
Combined.
Yeah, so that was year one of marriage. And then, so 2014, we wrote it. And, I mean, we went all around town. Everybody said no. All the majors, all the indies, literally.
And were you chasing an artist deal with that song, or were you also mm-hmm. pitching the song as
no.
well? So you wrote it, you're like, it's mine.
Yeah,
I'm totally. Going to die on this hill.
Yeah, this whole time I was like, I'm an artist writer. You know, like, that was what I wanted to do. And so, yeah, it was just like, we obviously didn't take no for an answer, but I just put everything on this one song. I was like, I know this is a hit. And it took, I mean, another 2 years from writing it to go to labels and showcases and do the whole dance. And it wasn't till 30 Tigers / now Triple Tigers, they've just started a whole brand new label. And it was Norbert Nix, who had just got let go from Sony, and like Kevin Herring, who just got let go from Warner. It's all these guys who kind of, you know, related to this like being rejected kind of mentality, like a little chip on your shoulder a little bit. And man, it just all came together with this tiny little label. I was the only artist on there, and they had me, one song, and that was what really ignited. I mean, I missed the whole video part, but no, industry wise, that was what really like took it. You know,
at what point? Because the label was a small independent label,
tiny.
So it's difficult because they don't have the promotion infrastructure, right, for an independent. Mm-hmm. They just don't have arms and fangs everywhere. Mm-hmm. So, but at what point though did you realize, oh, we actually have a shot with this thing? Like, this thing could actually be a massive hit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what was it, a number on the chart?
Yeah, was like top 30, really.
I was
going
to say top 30, yeah.
Yeah. Like,
you're like,
were you hearing about research?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Because it was also a ballad.
Exactly.
And oh, dear God, don't ever play a ballad.
But then it started jumping. Like, it was only in the 20s for like 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something mm-hmm. like that. It was like, jump 2 spots, jump 3 spots, jump. And then it was in the teens. And we were like, whoa, what's happening?
Yeah.
Did you do this song on any TV, on any anything?
On our favorite.
Did you do The Bachelor?
Bachelorette.
It seems like The Bachelorette. Okay, I don't know this, but it seems like this would be that kind of song.
Yeah.
Big pop from that show?
Absolutely.
Who was the couple?
Rachel and Dean. Rachel, she was like
two Bachelorettes ago?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah.
Dean was just...
Deanie Babies. Do you know Dean? Bachelor in Paradise, he came back.
I've never seen it.
The mustache.
I'm not the guy to talk
about. Yeah, me neither. Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know Rachel. But I bet
she was great.
Okay, so
she's an attorney. She's smart. She's really cool.
You play this on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And before it was ever on radio, I'm pretty sure. Or no, it was on radio and it jumped.
Does
it
pop so hard
40s.
Though after that? Like, yeah. You play it?
It jumped like 10 spots on AirPlay, and top of the iTunes charts. You know, just like craziness. That was a big jump.
When you played that song on the show, did you do it over and over again?
Yeah.
Was it
like
awkward too? Are you just playing with them? Like, what was the scene? What was that
so
whole thing?
So awkward.
Well, they were late, first of all. So it all started where we never had a tour bus before.
No.
But we got to like ride down in a tour bus. And then
to where?
To
South Carolina.
South Carolina. Okay. Yeah. And then so we're waiting. I think Chris Harrison like felt bad. So he comes on our bus. And, you know, we raise a toast, we have a drink, and we're just like hanging out with Chris Harrison on our bus, which for us at the time, we were like, oh,
I was freaking
God,
out. He was there for like 2 hours, and we had Knob, right? No.
It was like
Maker's Mark.
Yeah.
And I had him sign the bottle, and I have it in my house.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, I'm a fan. And he let us come.
She, every Monday, like, her and her gal pals get together and watch Bachelor.
He's also really nice.
He's so nice.
Amazing.
He let us come to After the Final Rose. He was like,
really?
How many tickets do you want? I was like, is 12 too many?
Legitimately.
And he was like, no, we'll make it happen. Me and all my friends filed in. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so fun. Yeah. It was really cool to, like, make it a real life experience and not so, like, this is the show.
Yeah. That's cool that you got to watch him play on the show and you got to hang, because you're a fan.
Yeah.
When you're a fan of something, it's so much cooler when it actually works out in a way that makes you still feel good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it was fun.
Yeah.
Like, it was, I think the whole thing is a crazy phenomenon, and do I think it's the best way to find someone? No. Am I highly entertained by drama that has nothing to do with my own life?
Yes.
I love it.
Are they dancing? Is it a dance scene?
Yeah, it's like a slow dance makeout scene.
And how many times do you think you have to play that song?
It was only like two.
With them dancing, it was like two or three. But
do they
like,
have to make out every time on cue?
No. Oh. They
made out.
But they wanted to. It wasn't like make out at this.
Yeah.
It wasn't choreographed.
Yeah.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct-to-consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com.
T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. T-E-C-O-V-A-S.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Reba on how a bad review from USA Today ended up leading to the success of her TV show, Reba.
Whenever you started to do Reba, your television series, did you guys get a straight deal or did you do a pilot and then the pilot got picked up?
I was in the midst of doing Annie Get Your Gun. We went in April. I took 10 days off from Annie Get Your Gun to go to California, shoot the pilot. Then we went to Upfronts, which is in May, and I had done 8 shows that week. I got Monday off. Tuesday morning was Upfronts, so I had to be butt crack of dawn over there. And they changed the name 3 times. When we filmed the show for the pilot, it was the script was called Sally. And Narva went to him and said, you know, if you did the afternoon filming as Sally and then in front of the audience, tape it and Reba be Reba instead of Sally, then let's see how that tests out. And they said, okay. So the title went from Sally. By the time I got to Upfronts, it was Deep in the Heart because we were all from Houston, Texas, and we were the Heart family. So then there came out this thing on USA Today that their publicist had said why the WB had ever hired Reba McEntire for this part is ridiculous. She's not of our...
Like our demo?
Yeah, she's not our demographics. And so the head of the company called by the time we got back to the hotel after Upfronts and said, terribly sorry. What can we do to make up for this? Well, I'd already gone back to bed. I had a performance that night, so Narva was talking to her, and he heard me get up and go to the bathroom and out of the other room, and he said, hang on, let me put Reba on the line. He banged on the bathroom door and said, pick up the phone. And I said, hello. He said, we're terribly sorry what happened and what was in the USA Today. What can we do to make this up to you? And I was half asleep, and I said, well, she said, well, Narva said if we call it Reba, you'll be happy with that. And I said, that's a wonderful idea. Thank you. Hung up, went back to bed. So that's how I got the name Reba.
And so you go, did you move out to L.A.? Oh. Because it was that, like you said, hey, I just got to go. If I'm going to do this, I don't need to visit it. I need to go live it.
Oh, we were there 3 weeks. So what happened was I got through with Annie Get Your Gun on June 23rd. We went to Ireland for a vacation. I did 5 weeks all-girl tour and then went to L.A., found an apartment, a condo we lived in for the first season, because you never know.
Right.
It could go 13 weeks and you don't get picked up. But then we got picked up on the back nine. And then Narvel went house hunting, and we bought a house, and we were there for 6.5 seasons.
Did that ever feel like home out there?
Oh, yeah. I loved living in L.A. I'd love to go back and do another show.
Would you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Have you guys, you know, explored different versions of that?
Mm-hmm.
Have you been close?
Uh-huh. Real close.
Have you shot a pilot to anything?
Yeah. The Mark Cherry pilot. We did one called Oxblood, and they passed on it.
It's always a weird thing, because I've shot a few pilots and had it passed on, where you feel like everybody's so pumped about it.
Yeah.
And everybody loves it. But then mine have been talk shows. And like, oh, this is it. Research has been great.
Yeah.
It's tested so wonderfully. Well, let's spend some money. Well, it just right now. Well, right. So is that show's done?
That show's done, okay. Unfortunately, which I thought it was going to, you know, mm-hmm. last forever. I thought I'd retire off of that show.
Well, I mean the Oxblood, that show.
That's it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mark Cherry.
Yeah.
I love his show now, Why Women Kill. It's just, he is a genius.
I saw my wife watching that show one day, and I was like, why are you watching? Why? I don't know what it was about.
Just exactly what are your motives?
Like, why are we learning from this show?
And what's the notepad, and you're taking
yes,
notes.
Yes. Here's Kane Brown's manager, Martha Earls, on getting fired before an award show for spending too much time with her new artist at the time, who was Kane Brown. Now, this is right before he exploded on the country music scene.
I let go of other things or other people, other clients I had fired me. I remember one person fired me like the night of the CMAs because I was paying too much attention to Kane. And honestly, that was all a gift, right? Because for the first two and a half, 3 years we worked together, it was all we did. We were so focused. Kane and I were like laser beam locked in. And if something came at me that didn't have anything to do with what our mission, I just ignored it.
When you guys were kind of making your early plan, was it, hey, people are going to tell you don't look like country music, and here's what we're going to do back at that?
Yeah, I mean, people, it wasn't even I didn't even think about, oh, we're going to retaliate.
But it can be, we're going to put out great songs over and over again.
Yeah, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing.
Right.
And super serve the fans and super serve the people that are there for you. You know, and that's even the advice now. It's like even Kane and I talk about it now where people are so mean on the internet. And it's like, just lean into the ones that are kind, you know?
Yeah, whenever I moved here, it was awful. I mean, the first 2.5 years were awful for me here. Awful.
I can't imagine.
And it wasn't just Nashville, because Nashville kicked the crap out of me for a long time. But it was, you know, they took us and put us on all of these country radio stations, which meant a lot of these stations had radio guys that were either retiring or they were firing because ratings weren't good. And so we weren't just feeling it on a level here at home. We were getting it in every single market. So I had to tell my guys, like, stay off of everything. Let me handle it. Stay off of it. But what we're going to do, we're never going to get those people. They may in a couple years come back around, but we got to take our people who are with us and make sure they know that they are the most important thing and that's who we're here for. And so it was a version of that where we just knew we weren't getting those people that were upset that we existed.
Yeah, you can't. And that'll exhaust you. And why not lean into what's working? And because eventually they'll start growing. And for you, for Kane, for whoever, then they start outnumbering the dissenters. And then all of a sudden they start quieting the dissenters. And that's where you want to be.
And then some of the dissenters come back around and go, you know what? I didn't really give you a chance at first.
That's right.
But they never say they were wrong, by the way. They never say they were wrong. They're just like, you know, I hated you at first. And now, you know, my sister likes you. They won't even say they like us, but they're like, hey, my sister likes you. But I know what that feels like to go and not the same way at all because we do different things, but just have everyone immediately go, you're not us and you don't represent us. When in the end, I represented them more than anything in the past that had claimed to do so. Which was the craziest thing to me.
Exactly. But you never had that opportunity to even express that.
So when Kane is putting out the first music as a managed, was he signed yet? Or did you do that with him?
Yeah.
It feels complicated.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Okay, so when you put out your first music that you're going to go to DSPs, digital or radio, like your first, this is our first big release together. Why did you choose the body of work that you chose? Like, what was it to you that said, here, this is our entrance into the big world?
Yeah, when I first started working with Kane, he had put some songs out independent. He was in a production deal and independently had put some songs out, and they did really well. So then when he made his first, like you said, it was an EP. It was a 5 or 6 song EP for Sony. It was a couple of those songs that he had put out, you know, because they'd never really been included in a collection of work. And then the other were when Kane, he did really work on his songwriting when he came to town. He really worked on songwriting and found his small group. And so the others were songs that he had written that he was proud of. And Kane was touring. He was selling out. What was crazy is he was selling out 1,500, 2,000 cap rooms without having any product out. It was wild. And so we really couldn't get that first EP out quick enough.
So when you put out, what was the first song? I'm trying to think about it.
Used to Love You Sober was his first kind of song.
So why that one?
That one was a song that was the first song he ever wrote when he came to Nashville, and he put it on social media. And Kane was one of the first artists to tease their music in Nashville, at least. I don't want to outside Nashville, other people were doing it, but in Nashville to really tease his music on social media. And the demand for it was so high that he put it out.
Were you satisfied with the reaction and also the success of the song? Because it wasn't a number one, I don't think.
It was a number 37.
Okay. But did you feel like, hey, we got some good traction here with the first one, or were you disappointed?
Well, we put it out, and it at the time, iTunes was a thing. You know, iTunes really mattered, and it did really well on iTunes. And it was number one on iTunes. We're like, oh my gosh, when we put this, take this to the radio, it's going to be like an instant hit. And it wasn't. And so that was a bit of a reality check. And the thing about it is with Kane was selling all these tickets. And so we were like, you know what? We're still connecting with people, obviously, because they're coming out and seeing the show, and the song was a gold record and all of this stuff. So we just had, you just have to kind of keep moving, keep working towards something.
Second song?
The second song, the label chose, it was called Thunder in the Rain.
You know what? I don't remember that one. I remember I know the first one.
Thunder in the Rain went to like number 48. It was not not necessarily the greatest one we had. And so Thunder in the Rain, I remember when that was out, it was up-tempo. And it was like, okay, this is – but it was real – musically, it wasn't really as much Kane. It's not like he performs it live every night or whatever. But by this point, he had made a full album. And so we put out his first full album with a number 48 song coming off the chart.
Are you guys like – it's like two worlds. It's like one world. You're selling
yeah.
both tickets
yeah.
and music.
Yeah.
Because at the time, that was the thing. We actually sold downloads. But then you have, I'm assuming, these old school gatekeeper radio programmers that just aren't buying it. I mean, is buying it the term that you would use?
I mean, there was, I think... you know, and I would never say who. I don't even know if they're still around. But I remember there was one person at a station, and I didn't really get in the weeds on that because, you know, the record labels have like whole teams of people that talk to the radio and stuff. But somehow, I don't know. I think because we were doing a show in the market, and I remember I was talking to this guy, and he I was like, hey, Kane sold out the show in your market, And it would be awesome, like, if you could, you know, maybe, like, play the song. We'd love to.
He sold out the show in their market, and you're begging for some little radio
and
support.
Oh, yeah. That happened everywhere. And the guy said, well, I don't play urban music. I play country music. And I said, oh, I know. That's wonderful, because Kane Brown is a country artist. And he said, no, he's not. And I said, yes, he is. It was comical almost. And yes, he is. And he goes, I know he's not. I just looked at him. And I said, okay, well, maybe you should go listen to him. And that was the end of the conversation. And he did not play the song. I looked at him. I know he's not country. I looked at him.
And I'm assuming, again, I'm going to do a lot of assuming here, that as Kane has, and Kane's, again, and we're going to end this in a little bit, talking about how massive he is, yet still underappreciated, that, again, how massive he is in places, that's probably still happening in a way. And I think that's probably why he's not getting the respect he deserves.
I think, do you mean like for award nominations?
I mean,
like that?
For everything.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes, uh, I I don't know, maybe people put their vote behind what they see themselves in, and maybe they're
superficial
and don't see themselves in how somebody looks, perhaps. Mm,
well, then I will say it. I do think that is a major. There is just no reason that an artist, if you take away faces and skin color and genitals, let's pull all that off, okay? It's the weirdest shape.
Sure, it's like there. A Mr. Potato Head.
Yes, it's that. And you just line up body of work, songs, streams, hits, radio number ones, concert. There's no reason that Kane shouldn't be, and he is to people like me and fans, but to the people that are organizing these higher level awards, there's no reason he shouldn't be in those conversations. Thanks for listening to this Bobbycast. Hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you look at the famous failures that we had here and you leave this feeling inspired by hearing how things may not always go the way you had hoped, but it can actually turn into something pretty awesome if you just don't quit. Also, you just can't predict the future, so don't stop pushing. Be sure to subscribe to the Bobbycast wherever you're listening to this now. Rate it 5 stars if you don't mind. That'd be all. Because when people give us 1 star, we keep pushing, don't we, Mike?
Mm-hmm. Keep going.
We keep going. So we could use those 5 stars. We'll be back next Friday with a brand new episode. We appreciate you guys. And we'll see you next time on the Bobbycast.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.